Welcome to this new podcast series from Green Alliance, the charity and think tank that's all about achieving ambitious leadership for the environment. I'm Amy Mount, and today I'm bringing you the best bits from the second of three live debates exploring the controversial questions about the future of land, our food, and the environment. In this episode, what should be the priorities for UK food production after Brexit? What are the implications of giving up control of food standards to trading partners like the US and buying more food from abroad? Or are there opportunities to better protect the environment and help us all eat more healthily? Those are the big questions we put to our expert panel.
Good evening, everybody. My name's Charlotte Smith. I hold the bundle of self-important papers. That means that I am in charge, and I'm hoping that the panel in particular are taking notice of that. So our panel this evening, Anna Taylor, who is Executive Director of the Food Foundation, Sir Peter Kendall, who is a farmer and Chair of the AHDB, Vicky Hurd, Campaign Coordinator for Food and Farming Policy at Sustain, and on the end, Andrew Opie from the British Retail Consortium, which represents retailers. So firstly, let's get from our panellists. I've asked them for three brief outlines of three priorities they identify here. Anna, I'm sorry, I'm going to start with you because you had the foolishness to sit next to me.
Thanks, Charlotte. Okay, 3 points. My first priority really would be to think about good quality, healthy food as being one of the public goods which is being linked to public payments in the thinking around the future of agriculture policy. And I think in the absence of that, it's an important missed opportunity. At the moment, we've got a lot of work going on at the sort of consumer end of the supply chain around trying to get us to eat healthier diets, whether it's the sugar tax, whether it's banning junk food advertising. And we're not thinking at all about the role of farming and agriculture. So that's my first point. The second, really, which is sort of linked to that theme, is that I'd like to see a much greater priority given to fruit and veg and British horticulture specifically. The sector, as you'll know, faces some particular threats at the moment. It's been largely unsubsidised, not entirely, but largely unsubsidised under the Common Agricultural Policy relative to other sectors of farming. It's got particular challenges now around labour. And for that reason, and because it's really, apart from perhaps the exception of oily fish, the only food that we actually need to be eating a lot more of in the UK, we need to start thinking about the role that agriculture policy can play in helping to keep prices of fruit and veg stable. And then my third point is that I don't think we need to be thinking about production in isolation. And I think we can be thinking about the role of policy in helping to stimulate demand for the right kinds of food. We've got, obviously, the government has a huge lever with public procurement. The public purse that's used to purchase food for consumption is huge. We also have to be thinking about what is the role of public health policy in trying to tackle these dramatic dietary inequalities that we have.
Thank you. Peter, your three priorities.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Charlotte. And also thank you to the Green Alliance for involving us, because I think at a time like this, if all of us in this room and across this platform can't find things to agree on, it would be a sorry state of affairs, particularly such a serious time for agriculture. My three are going to be slightly different to Anna's. I think we do need to establish right from the start an ambition for British agriculture to play both a serious and a meaningful role in feeding the nation in a profitable and sustainable way. This notion that we can wind down British agriculture, we can have cheap food imports, we need to establish that before we set other priorities, that we do want to play a meaningful and serious role in feeding the nation. Then I think we should think about how we invest and incentivise a highly skilled and well-invested industry that can use the latest smart technology to pinpoint inputs to carefully produce high-quality food without impacting negatively on the environment. And I think we're on the cusp of the next agricultural revolution, the digital agricultural revolution for the 21st century, that will allow us to farm in a way that even my father would never have dreamt of. My third point is actually one for the regulators, and it alludes a bit to the report that was published today. And we can do this through a free trade arrangement. We should not have imports coming in that do not meet our standards. And I think we could legislate for that in the agricultural bill. They're my 3 points, Charlotte.
Great. Vicky.
Thank you, and thank you, yes, for inviting me to speak. My three points are on diversity, on coherence, and on fairness. So on diversity, we need to think about making sure that we don't find a huge number of our farmers go for the cliff edge when we've got new schemes in place which haven't been designed to make sure that farmers can survive, can grow sustainably and in ethical ways. That means really making sure that we can have a diverse farm size network across the country to make sure they can survive as creative enterprises for the future. Just don't dismiss those that are inefficient now. Make sure they can do what they need to do and produce and possibly diversify, which is the other element of diversification, diverse their production. Second point, coherence. Coherence with, as Anna absolutely says rightly, public health policy, thinking about how we can really support farming, which delivers really good, healthy produce, more fruit and veg, possibly diversifying, that diversification issue again, but coherence with other policies, including health policy, including rural development, making sure rural communities can survive and thrive and be part of a rural farm economy. We don't want the illusion of coherence. We don't want fine words and fancy titles. We actually want coherence with environmental and health policy. And final point, fairness. Fairness in the supply chain was a chapter of the Health and Harmony consultation. It was too weak. We really wanted to see very strong new measures to make sure that the whole supply chain is fair, deals fair, so that farmers can actually pay their workers well, can actually treat the land and the animals well, because they've got a fair deal in the supply chain and being treated. Fairness in the supply chain is essential, and fairness for workers. And for that, we would like to see England, which doesn't have, like Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, England to have some form of collective bargaining for workers, the 140,000 workers in the supply chain, which get very rarely mentioned in these debates. They don't get invited to these debates. And yet they should have a means by which they can say what they want out of a future farming system and be able to collectively bargain for decent wages and conditions. But that needs all the other things to happen as well. Farmers need to have the fair deal. That's probably too much. Sorry. 3 points.
We have got a lot to talk about already. Andrew, give us some more.
I'm going to give 3 points from the perspective of the consumer, and mine are probably more immediate about what we need to do about Brexit. So the first thing is we need a zero tariff deal with the EU. Crucial for the 80% of our imports come from the EU, so it'd have an impact on the price that consumers pay in stores, but also for farmers, their biggest market for exports. And if they can't export into the EU, that affects their long-term financial sustainability. The second is we need to have a properly managed migration policy that meets the demand, both of the supply chain, so that's farm workers and supporting those who are farm workers, but also for us in retail and logistics and distribution, where we're particularly exposed in terms of a lack of UK employees in that sector. And then the third thing, crucially, is around border controls. So food is particularly sensitive to border controls. Sanitary and phytosanitary inspections at borders will hold up food as it comes across both borders, both for exporters into Europe, but crucially for many of the perishable products which come into the UK. I was looking at strawberries, which most of the time we buy here in the UK, but for about 3 or 4 months of the year we import from places like Spain and Morocco. They generally have a 3-day shelf life by the time they get to the store. They get held up at the port because most of it comes through Calais, across to either Folkestone or Dover. Then that might take a whole day of their life, and then it becomes standard 2 days availability. And I don't think many UK customers out there want to lose the kind of produce that they've currently got access to. So border controls, tariff controls, and labour controls.
Okay, as I say, that's just scratched the surface then, hasn't it? Let's start with this idea of cheaper imports. Do cheaper imports, Peter, always mean worse standards? If we're importing cheaper food from somewhere else, does that always equate with a worse standard?
No, it doesn't. Have to be honest. There's some products are available that would be sometimes, I'll say this as a ex-president of the NFU, that sometimes produce better quality. Jacob Rees-Mogg met Myra Raymond, who was then president of the NFU at the Tory party conference, and he said, we're going to save so much money by buying cheap food, we're going to be able to pay twice the subsidies to farmers in a typical Jacob Rees-Mogg way. And I thought, dream on all the farmers for one. But the challenge with cheap food becomes when you get boom and bust in agriculture. So actually, I see being British agriculture having to be more competitive. I can see us having to live with less support and more competition. What you can't have is an absolute bumper harvest somewhere in the world that, because the other big trading blocks around the world protect their agriculture, when you squeeze a balloon, it pops out here. And that load is dumped on actually British markets, and it completely undermines our ability to invest, to plan, to structure production. So, yes, you can have higher production. What you mustn't become is a dumping ground, particularly at times of boom and bust or surplus around the world.
Anna, when it gets to a trade agreement, though, particularly with, for instance, the United States of America, and I am going to talk about infamous chlorinated chicken, although the American Agriculture Secretary was at pains to say when I interviewed him about this that it's not washed in chlorine anymore, it's washed in a completely different detergent. So his argument is, doesn't matter, you label it, and people in supermarkets can either decide to buy it, and it will, he promises me, be cheaper, or you don't buy it. What's the problem?
There's a few problems. One is that for the most part, people don't pay attention to labels. We have this illusion that label is the first place to start, you know, if you want to kind of inform people about the right things to be eating. And all the evidence points to the fact that people's concentration span when they're shopping is microseconds. Unless they've got a particular health condition or an allergy or something which is driving them to behave in a particular way. So first of all, we know that labels don't work that well. And I think also the complexity of the story around the supply chain is not possible to communicate well in a label. And so we need policies around that are going to actually be for the benefit of citizens. And in this instance, I mean, animal welfare, obviously, that's the kind of at the heart of the issue around chlorinated chicken. So labels aren't good enough.
From a retailer's point of view, Andrew?
Well, it's interesting listening about labels. Generally, we're getting lectured by some of the people on the panel to label everything with a little bit more, actually. So now being told that labels don't work, I'll be taking that back into my wider policy work after this discussion. So that was useful in itself. Second point, I don't think at the moment there is any appetite for people to be selling chlorinated chicken on the shelves. And in fact, chicken is one of the products in UK supermarkets pretty much primarily sourced here. I don't see that changing, but I think, you know, we need to be careful when we talk about consumers here, because consumers, their trade deal will be looking at more than food, for example. And I think the other thing that comes down to it is we can have all these labels and standards, but actually every retailer you go into has his own values that they will be selling their brand values. And therefore, if people don't want chlorinated chicken, they won't sell chlorinated chicken. It doesn't matter whether it's made available under a US trade deal or not, if it doesn't suit. Now, the problem you may get is other parts of the food sector might take it. And where actually, back to labelling, where labelling is actually much less prevalent than it is in
retail. So catering, for instance.
So you wonder whether it then starts to supplant some of the, maybe not even UK produce, but maybe European produce, which is currently on the market. So that's where I would see it being more of an issue. But currently, with the way I look at brand values, I don't see it being a problem. Having said that, brand values, consumer perspectives on value do change over the years.
And there might be more pressure because of a predicted rise in food prices.
Well, that's the really interesting thing, of course, about Brexit. You know, even after the referendum, we did see, because of the devaluation of the pound in terms of the currency, we did see food prices rise up to about 4% a peak, which doesn't sound very much, but that's a lot in terms of food price inflation, where we've seen decades, really, of food price deflation over that time. So we may well see prices. And I think, Peter, you had this data in one of your reports, which the IGD had pointed out, that I think 70-odd% of people said they would buy more British if it was the right value. So there's always that big if. There is a price kind of elasticity where that will snap eventually if the price difference is too much. People may be prepared to then go and buy a product, even clearly labelled, even understanding what it is.
I have to do my, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous bit now and say I'm an intensive chicken farmer, and explain to you that I keep lots of chickens in sheds. And it's an incredibly fast-growing market. And we supply Nando's, we supply Asda, we supply Lidl and Aldi through our supplier. Today, McDonald's sells more chicken than it does beef. It is a really rising demand for those chickens. But I'm under enormous environmental regulation. The sort of capture of any sort of runoff, the investment in the buildings is enormous. And actually, we always have to have a week's clear period where the sheds are completely empty and washed out so I don't use antibiotics.
So what does that mean for the price?
It means my chicken is more expensive than American chicken, where they will layer on manure crop on crop and then either wash the chicken in or detergent or give them antibiotics. Now, there is a drive in the States to use less antibiotics, but I'm competing with very, very different standards. And I get the point, Andrew, that the retailers might not choose to sell it. Are massive. We now eat more calories out of the home than we do in the home. And that's where I'm going to face competition.
Question. Lady here. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Belinda Gordon from the Campaign to Protect Rural England. And I just wanted to hear a bit more about trade deals and our chances of getting decent deals and what the main challenges will be. I don't know if anyone's got an easy answer to that.
Yeah, great. How long have you got?
Well, I mean, the problem is, so this is a great document on the BRC website, so you can look it up. But what is really good in there's a map in here of the world and potential benefits for consumers of future trade deals. Red for bad, green for good. And unfortunately, almost all the reds are in food because most of our imports come from the EU where we currently don't pay any tariffs. Now, there are some greens. So, for example, we could get a better deal from South Africa on citrus fruit because we're a bit stymied by the Mediterranean countries in terms of the way we can import citrus, for example. There are some countries like America where we don't have a deal where we might want to import wine and berries and things like that for food that we would do better. But generally, food is the big risk. The greens are really a non-food. So, you know, a proper deal with China, for example, in future when Vietnam comes out of its GSP status to do a deal with Vietnam on shoes and things like that will be great for consumers. So actually, that was the point I was making earlier, that the government has, you know, it won't do a deal on food, it will do a trade deal. And I guess the concern for those in food is how much food might get partly sacrificed within that deal to get some of the other advantages around other bits of the trade deal.
I just want to throw into this two questions which sort of fit, both anonymous on the app. Should the UK just adopt EU standards for food, irrespective of whatever deal anybody's offering? And if a new trading future relying, for instance, on US trade deals is so bad, should food and farming make a stronger case to stay in the single market and closer to the EU instead? Andrew, can you comment just briefly on that idea that actually we need to stay closer from a food point of view to the EU?
In terms of regulation, I think we need to stay close, but I'm not sure if I'm looking purely from food rather than production, whether everything that the EU has imposed on the UK is a good thing. So, for example, a few years ago, we asked to relax all of the marketing standards on fruit and vegetables. There are still, what, 8 or 9, I think, Anna, still standing, which the EU has maintained, which forces us to sell certain types of fruit and vegetables for that. We wanted to make mandatory front-of-pack labelling for nutrition labelling. We were stopped from doing that, and the Italians are currently taking a case against the UK because they claim that it may stop sales of Parmesan cheese and various other things. Allergen marking was another one. We had a great system in this UK that people really understood where we took allergens out and put it in a box so you could read it really. That was stopped under the food information regulations when they came in. So actually, I'm not 100% in support of EU regulations, but I understand the importance for trading and recognising where the Europeans are. So in the current trade deal, Europe is saying you can only have mutual recognition of standards, which would maybe get rid of some of these checks, if you have full regulatory alignment. Our government is saying we don't want regulatory alignment on food and agriculture because we want the opportunity maybe to move to different standards for our export markets in particular. We don't see how you can square that circle at the moment because we need the border checks to run smoothly, because if we can't, we have an absolute nightmare, particularly through that Calais corridor across to here, and we will start to see problems in terms of getting food on the shelves.
I think there's a lot of really good standards that we'd notwithstanding what Andrew's saying about a few maybe anomalies, there's an awful lot of really good standards to do with labelling, to do with safety, to do with environment in which farmers are growing their food, all sorts of things, checks and balances that Europe provides with us. And I think we'd be at a great loss to lose those. But one of the biggest risks we have, which you know, Belinda, is that we have no say in any of these trade deals. If you look at Andrew's map, Liam Fox has been all around the world. If you look at the map, if you see that Guardian article, he's been everywhere to start doing those smoothing of the waters to talk about trade deals. And a lot of them aren't anything to do with food. Some of them are. And yet he could come back and do the deals. And at the moment, our parliamentarians, and therefore us, have no say. So the most important thing that needs to happen is that we need to demand that our parliamentarians have a say in those trade deals, that we have trade democracy, and that they can veto them. But at least they can debate. They should be able to debate them, but they can't even do that now. You know, we've had two huge deals placed upon us through Europe, which we were furious about, the CETA, the Canadian one, and the TTIP. I can't believe I've forgotten that name, the US one. Anyway, so, you know, that is just insane that our parliamentarians don't have any say in trade deals when they have... Trade deals are actually more about standards and non-tariff barriers. They're not really about trade these days.
Anna.
I completely agree. I think the other thing perhaps to mention, of course, is the precautionary principle and how important that's been in the whole European regulations that have been set up and why that is so critically different from, say, the US model in terms of the review of evidence used to inform regulations. And it's hugely important in terms of determining your sort of starting point for what you regulate. And so in that sense, I think there's a huge amount to protect. But I think the other point to make is a kind of practical one in the sense that actually our capacity as a nation to regulate in some of these areas has now been stripped back to pretty much. I mean, the Food Standards Agency is not what it was. And in a situation where we might, if we are wanting to bring regulations in this area, I think we're going to struggle just from a practical and expertise perspective.
Let's leave that there. Let's take a question from the lady at the back with the blonde hair.
Alice Page, Swithin Estates. A very blunt question. I just wonder, what is the future of British farming post-Brexit in the light of a reducing availability of land due to growing population and the possibility of massive cheap imports?
Go on then, Mr. Farmer. What's your future, given that reality?
The cheap imports is the one that I really worry about. It does depend on what tariff rate quotas might be put in place. It might depend on whether there's any sort of tariff barriers whatsoever, what sort of rules we have, exactly as Alex touched on non-tariff barriers, which are really critical. But, you know, if we did go down the Rees-Mogg, you know, let's become the Singapore of Northern Europe model, it would be devastating for British agriculture. You know, it really would. However you view it. And what I find bizarre is that James Dyson, who was one of the cheerleaders of Brexit, went on the Andrew Marr show and said how great it was going to be. We were going to get rid of all those restrictive labour rules. We're going to be able to hire and fire people. But he still wants his £1.6 million of subsidy because he can't compete on his enormous acreage at global prices. And I just don't know anybody. Now, as I say, I can see us managing with significantly less support over time, with the right improvements. If you improve our efficiency and productivity, we can replace a big chunk of subsidy. We can't cope with being a dumping ground.
Can I just play devil's advocate here?
As you, again?
If you have a skill, I've only got one. Would it matter if I get my wheat from the place where they grow wheat the best, perhaps even environmentally less impact? If I get my lamb from wherever that is best, does it really matter? Do we just accept that things change? And the countryside will change and farming will change, but it will be okay.
History has taught us, as an island like this, to depend on other people to feed us is absolutely bonkers. Having a basic level of supply is the first thing of any government, is to feed your people. Why on earth First World War, 20% of our wheat. Second World War, about 30% of our wheat. We came within days of starving. Listen, and you'll have interviewed him, John Bedding, today. Talk about climate change. Talk about water scarcity. Wars about water around the world. All the impacts that are going on today. And we're saying we're happy to be fed by other people. As I said, Putin is the biggest exporter of wheat. I don't trust him much.
Years and years ago, I started a campaign called Food Miles back in 1996. Produced the first Food Miles report, which you remember well. And we talked about everything to do with long-distance transport of food. And, you know, it's interesting what you were saying there, but one of the things that was a real central theme was the power in the food chain. Who's got the power and where does the value go in the food chain? And the further away it is, the more like you're not going to know. You're not going to know the standards. You're not going to know your producer. You're not going to be able to trace it. That's not so true. Blockchain, I'm told, you'd be able to have full trust and faith in the chain. And maybe that's a digital future we will face. But the nearer to market, and particularly for perishable, is going to be better for health. So there's all sorts of reasons to have a nearer market as possible, but that's not an absolute. One thing I did want to talk about land, though, you know, it's absolutely clear we're using an awful lot of land badly for food production. And I'm going to be controversial now for a very large amount of cheap meat and dairy products. And if we really wanted to preserve land for producing produce direct for consumption, we should possibly be thinking about eating a lot less and better meat and not feeding crops to cars. And not wasting food goes without saying.
We're going to take one brief question with brief answers, if we can.
Hello, Alex Adam from the Rivers Trust. In lieu of the very tight margins that the retailers are working to,
thank you.
The need for behaviour change and reduction in food waste, change in diets, perhaps, and funding for innovation, is our food too cheap?
Vicky, is our food too cheap?
I'd probably say yes, because there's loads of hidden costs that aren't paid by the market. But we need food to be affordable, and it, that's the key. It should be affordable and accessible and not overly processed. I think that would help save a lot of money. But then we don't want to start talking about people getting educated at school to cook, because that's inevitably every meeting I go into,
say,
you end up talking
let's
about
not raise that
educating
now.
Children. So it's about, you know, really a big shift. We'd like to see a big shift and have much more fresh, available produce for people locally, and the cost of the full cost of production paid by the market, not necessarily by the farmers.
Peter, is food too cheap?
If we become a dumping ground, it could be a lot cheaper. So at the moment, it reflects, I think, the prices that markets dictate. So it feels as farmers at times, you know, 2 years ago, wheat was under £100 a tonne. You know, that was impossible to make a living at. But, you know, you put things together, you put off investments, you postpone things. But at the moment, wheat is on the brink of £160 a tonne. I wouldn't argue that's too cheap. I would say that's the market working. But if you want to add in all those externalities that we've talked about, then you have to raise the price. You can't add all those other costs in and say the farmer's got to pick up those costs unless the market reflects it. And if you do that, you've got to keep product out that doesn't meet those standards. So it reflects, I think, the environment we're working in today.
I think some foods are too cheap. I think when you look at, from a health perspective, unhealthy calories are three times cheaper than healthy calories. I think we need a shift in the balance of prices in the basket in order to make it easier for everyone to eat well.
I think it's great that food is affordable. You know, my grandparents wouldn't have been able to afford a roast dinner on a Sunday when they were maybe a little bit younger than me, but when they were of a certain age. I think it's fantastic that everybody has access to it. I agree that there are probably, we eat some wrong things because probably they are maybe, you know, priced at a certain point. I see these kind of chicken and chips deals in chicken places for a pound, you know, which are clearly aimed at kids, and you sort of wonder about those sorts of things. But generally, I think we have fantastic food produced in this country, which is affordable. And I think we should celebrate that fact. And actually, if you look at millions of customers, what do they spend doing every weekend? Trying to get the best deal for their food, shopping from one supermarket to another. So it's what customers want.
And on that note, with apologies to everybody else who wanted to ask a question or make another comment, I'm really sorry. And can I ask you to thank our panel this evening? Thank you.
That's it for this episode. I hope you enjoyed that. Make sure you subscribe in your favourite podcast app to get the next episode automatically.